Your relationship can't survive on the leftovers of your time, your energy, or your attention.
That's why we created Grounded in Love, a couples retreat in Sedona, Arizona on beautiful Oak Creek Canyon. It's October 22nd to 25th, which is a Thursday to a Sunday.
This isn't just a getaway. This is for intentional days to slow down, reconnect, build emotional safety, and create the kind of relationship you've been working so hard to build.
We'll guide you through powerful workshops, private coaching sessions, plenty of powerful experiential moments to connect the two of you, and plenty of time for just the two of you to enjoy.
We intentionally limited this retreat to 8 couples so that you could have a deeply personalized experience. We have filled half of the retreat, so we have 4 spaces remaining.
So if you've been looking for the right time to invest in your relationship, this is it. Click the link in the show notes or email us at coaching@relationshiprenovation.com, and we'll set up a 30-minute discovery call to make sure it's a great fit for you.
We'd love to spend the long weekend with you.
Have you hit pause in your relationship? Today, we're talking to Dr. Lee Bockham about how to bring your marriage back together, even if there's only one of you who's really interested in doing it.
Hello, all, and welcome to the Relationship Renovation Podcast. I am Tara Kerwin.
And my name is EJ Kerwin. And, you know, one of the primary things we have heard over the years, and whether that's at our center or people writing into the podcast or social media or whatever, is like, what do I do if I want to change our relationship? I'm not happy in the relationship, but my partner isn't there. They don't want to deal. They don't want to get help. They don't want to talk about it. And so today, we're super excited to talk to Dr. Lee Bockham. He's the creator of the Save the Marriage System, and he's a nationally recognized expert on relationship resilience and marital recovery. For more than 30 years, Lee has helped couples around the world navigate crisis, rebuild trust, and create stronger, healthier relationships. This is super impressive. He's the author of multiple books, and like I said earlier, he's the host of the Save the Marriage podcast. So welcome, Lee, to Relationship Renovation.
AJ, Tara, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, and what not better expert to ask this question to than a Save the Marriage coach? How do you help people when you have someone coming to you, right? Like, my partner doesn't want to get help, but I am just like so miserable. Like, we've seen it through the 10 years we've had our practice.
Yeah.
Like, help, what do you do, Dr. Bockham?
So we're going to back up a little bit to get to that place, because we got to go with what happened, and then we can talk about how you undo what happened. So let's start with that. I have this theory of the pause button marriage. And most of the time, let me say this, almost always, it's an accident that it happens. People mean to do what they do, but they don't know what's coming from that. And so if we track back, you know, people get married because they are so madly in love with this person, and they want to be with this person the rest of their lives. And then they have to get on with life.
Yeah.
And life could be the kids or a career or lots of other things, you know, dealing with aging parents, that kind of thing that we kind of touched on. Yeah. And so they hit the pause button thinking, we'll get back to us down the road once, whatever. And the problem is that's a creep, right? That it's once the kids are in school, once they're out of school, once they're in college, once they're out of college, you know, it keeps on rolling out until time has passed. And the problem is you can't pause a relationship. And so as you are in any relationship, it's either growing and expanding, or it's shrinking and really dying. And so that pause button isn't a suspended animation. It's not like the rocket ships that are in the science fiction movie where they punch the button and people come back awake and everything's just right where they were. It begins to recede.
Darn it.
And the problem is, generally, both people, now they're on these parallel paths, and they talk about, you know, being roommates and all of that, but they're not touching base with each other. So when one person says, this is really painful, the other person may not be at that point because they're still distracted or because they're still thinking we'll be okay down the road. And so we're already out of sync. If that makes sense, that already you're going to have one person realize that there's a problem rarely is it both kind of looking at each other and going, hey, we've got a problem. Let's work on it. It's generally one person going, oh, gosh, we're in trouble. So that's what sets up the scenario you're talking about. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's like the way you said it is perfectly. And it also reminds me, just like an individual metaphor, like after the holidays, I'll get back on track. I'll get back on track after the holidays and I'll get my exercise and my healthy eating. And then you go so far over the holidays and you're just like, why? What's the point? That's a lot of work. Yes.
After the next holiday, after vacation, it keeps extending.
Yeah,
exactly. We do that lots of places in life, and we do it with the best of intentions. So first, that is a thing to understand for couples, because a lot of times when a relationship is in trouble, there's a lot of finger pointing, and they want to assign who's at fault at this. And so just to clear that up, usually both people hit the pause button and both people are responsible, not at fault because you didn't know what was coming, but responsible to decide what to do from there. Mm-hmm. But one person can say, hey, I'm going to start this process.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings us currently to your question.
Yeah, I love the framing you did there is responsible versus at fault. Because I think that that's what, we have a counseling center and couples come in and they want us to tell them whose fault it is.
Right.
Right. And a big part of the process is getting people to come back to individual accountability.
Yeah.
And looking at it as a system though, that and there's some relief there, I would assume, right? In that it's not anybody's fault. It's just you're both responsible for not taking care of your relationship.
Right. And if we can even change it a little bit further, fault is always rear view looking. You're looking at where you've been. And I rarely find it helpful for me to be trying to get somewhere and be staring in the rearview mirror going, well, look at what happened back there. Look at that curve back there. It just doesn't get us any further down the road. There are times when we have to say, how do we do some repair work for whatever happened? Because people do act out from that painful disconnection. And so a lot of the symptoms we see that people point as the cause of their problems, their symptoms, the fights about money or kids or all these other pieces that can be the puzzles that people then want to say, well, whose fault was that? You've probably had the same experience I had in the office with people where, they'll tell you, one will say, well, this is what happened. And the other goes, oh, yeah, well, this is what happened.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just this ping pong match going on about, oh, yeah, well, and I'm pretty sure if I just let them run it, they'll run it all the way back to the first fight they had. In fact, that's one of the questions I've often used is, what is the first serious fight you ever had? And when we get to the underlying issue behind that, whatever it is about feeling like you don't have a voice or don't have control or you're not getting connection, all of those pieces, it's usually the same one they're still fighting about. They never solved it. Yeah. And they just dragged it along. So now we're playing the game of blame, which is always rearview mirror. Responsibility is saying, how do I want to move forward?
Absolutely.
One of my analogies I often use is, if your house is on fire, it is rarely helpful in that moment to be asking, who lit this fire? It is much more helpful to be going, how do we get out of here safely and what do we take with us?
Absolutely.
So after that, sure, there can be some place of saying we need to do some repair work about this. But in the moment of the heat, it's not particularly helpful or particularly accurate.
Yeah. I mean, but that kind of gets back to the topic a little bit, right? Is like, what happens if there's a fire in your marriage and you want to get to safety and change and put the fire out, and the other person is like, there's no fire.
Yeah. Or they're warming their hands by it.
Or this is comfortable. Like, I
don't know about you, but I'm okay.
Well, we've heard that, right? We've heard this is your problem. Like, I'm okay.
Right. And what has happened is the established distance for one is maybe not what they want. And you probably had the same thing I've had where people are like, well, I knew we weren't where we needed to be. I knew we weren't connecting the way we needed to. Yeah. I just didn't think we were that bad.
Yes. Yeah.
And the other person's going, it's time to divorce. So that mismatch is often because of one person's become okay with the distance and the other person has become attuned to the disconnection. And yeah. so we've got yeah. to work to find that, which brings us to the question. So what do you do if you're the one who wants to? Let's talk about a couple of things I think are not particularly helpful. One is forcing connection, trying to force the person to get closer. So you know that pursuer distancer thing that we all learn somewhere in training? I call it the chaser spacer. That's the, your one person is doing the chase and the other's doing the spacing. And if you want to know where you move to, it's the pacer. So you're a chaser or spacer and you want to be a pacer on either place, whether you're the chaser or the spacer, the better place is to be the pacer going, how can I pace along and increase the connection? So forcing connection is what we often hear where somebody says, we need to do date night. We need to go on a big romantic trip. You know, they do something that's too much for the container to hold right then. The connection is just not strong enough to manage that. Down the road, absolutely, that might be something. But in that moment of disconnection to say, I want super connection, usually means that whoever was kind of comfortable and warming their hands by the, you know, the fire going on is suddenly going, whoa, and they move further away.
Yeah.
And they distance further. So we have to work more from an invitational place. And part of that is about self-management, because we can easily get pulled into the panic and that fight-flight mode that is so easily triggered when you feel like something's threatened. If you feel like your relationship is threatened, this thing that you feel a commitment to is threatened, it can put you into fight-flight. And the unfortunate part of that is fight-flight always needs, you know, an enemy. There's something, not to something out there, but somebody beside you.
Absolutely.
And so that's where we see a lot of the distancing and the over-engaging that happens in that process.
Absolutely.
And that's just such a, we talk a lot about that, like what a horrible thing it is to feel towards the person that you want to feel the most connected to, the at one point you were just on fire for, to literally see them as a threat, to see them as unable to, you know, to make you feel special, like all of those things. Like it's heartbreaking, you know, it's heartbreaking when it happens. And, you know, as people who help couples, it's heartbreaking to see where you can see these two people who are like, oh, I see you love each other, but you perceive each other as the enemy.
Well, and it's so going back to, the self-management piece, because I remember it's 2014, Dr. Baucom, our twins are born, right? I've been a marriage therapist for 20 years. I'm like, we're totally good. Like we're having twins. And we had, EJ had two boys from his previous marriage. So I had four kids under five in a matter of a year and a half because I fell madly in love with this guy, right? And I'll just never forget this because this is a big part of like our model that we developed. Like EJ came through the door and I'm like, I hate you. I despise you. This is awful. You freaking gave me this stressful environment.
What did you do to me?
What did you do to me? I was like overwhelmed. I'd never been so overwhelmed. Our twins had colic, by the way. And then EJ had to take over my entire caseload. So he would work until 9 at night. And I remember thinking like, I am a monster. Like, why am I so angry? And I said, EJ, I literally said the word burnt toast. That's code word. I'm like, when I say burnt toast, that means I'm not good. I'm not going to say anything good. My body feels really bad. And I'm just going to like excuse myself because I don't want to hate you and I don't want to resent you. And I know this isn't your fault, but my brain is telling me that it is. And I remember like, that was like the beginning of like, we have to help other couples because that self-management piece to go and walk away so I wouldn't reinforce that resentment and overwhelm was so huge. And it didn't matter. Like I could go and do like meditation or I could go and read an Us magazine or I could go listen to a little Miles Davis, which I love, like brings me down. But it was like that first part of my own self-management is what even gave us the, we're here 11 years later, twins are 11, we're doing great, right? Had to go through a lot of stuff. But I just remember that was like, I didn't want to be who I was in that moment. And I was like, I've got to stop or this isn't okay.
Yeah. So your technique for that was to disengage so that you can then re-engage in it from a different state.
Absolutely.
And that is a mistake many people use. They don't even though they can feel the body ramping up, they're not able to disengage that.
Yeah.
And so they're stuck in this overwhelm. And so then they're either doing battle with their spouse or mm-hmm. pulling hard on their spouse, which when those are happening at the same time, is pretty confusing for the spouse that you're
yes.
trying to get back into connection.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting too, in that using your language here, the racer and the spacer. The racer
chaser.
Probably.
Chaser, spacer.
She's correct. Chaser, spacer, or pacer.
I imagine that the person who wants to get help, who wants to talk about it, is always going to be the chaser.
Yeah.
You know, it's always going to that's the person, which then would make the other person want to go away.
Yeah, yeah. I've often said that the chaser who is often watching. If you're the spacer, you're not likely going to be looking up stuff on how to save your marriage or you know, listening to podcasts or books. You're just going, hey, I'm good.
Yeah.
I just need some space here.
Yes.
So almost always they're the chaser that's looking to get help. And so they have to find a way of going, okay, I acknowledge what I'm doing, my intention of wanting to work on this, positive. The way I'm doing, maybe not helpful. And I've got to learn how to pace. So back to your discussion, Tara, that process of going, I've got to disengage to bring down my own internal compass. And there was a second piece that you kind of pointed to is you didn't want to make him the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, EJ didn't need to be the enemy. And it's such a temptation when they're just two. And so let's talk about a mindset shift that is really simple and is going to be as plain as day when I say it, but that is that the couple is a team.
Yeah.
And to always be going, what's the game that we're in? You know, what are we trying to win? For the two of you at that moment, it was, how do we get through this parenting craziness together as a team? And that's a different thing than, why are you not helping me? You know, why are you not following me? What's going on here? To have that mindset, I call it being a we. We are in this together. We're mm-hmm. a team. And when teams are working at their best, they are covering for each other's weaknesses instead of pointing out what you're doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to shore it up. I play pickleball, was playing way too long this morning. And, you know, when I'm playing with my partner, I'm like, we're the team. And you make a bad shot, I'm just going to go, hey, let's try again. I'm not going to mm-hmm. criticize it. I'm also going to be aware that maybe their bad shot was because my two shots back was the bad setup, right? And I have to take some responsibility. And I'm also going to just be watching going, what do I need to cover here?
Yeah.
So that's the team. The team shift is important.
If you feel like you and your partner keep having the same conversation over and over, if you feel like you keep trying to connect, but you just miss each other, then this is for you.
So many couples are not lacking love. They are, however, lacking a roadmap. They feel overwhelmed, frustrated, and they're trying to figure it out on their own. Trust me, we know.
And Tara and I are now coaching couples globally. And honestly, it's become one of our favorite things to do. We're moving couples from me versus you to we. We're helping couples build that healthy, loving connection that they've always wanted.
This isn't about learning one more communication tool. It's about understanding yourself more deeply, understanding your partner more deeply to build that compassion, developing emotional safety, and building the relationship that you want to have in your life.
And because Tara and I coach every couple personally, we only have a limited amount of spaces available at any given time. So if you think the coaching might be the right thing for you, we would love to meet you.
You can schedule a complimentary 30-minute discovery call where we hear your story, we tell you about how we do our work, make sure that we're a really good fit.
You can click the link in the show notes, or you can email us at coaching@relationshiprenovation.com.
So please reach out. We would love to walk alongside you. So then when the chaser recognizes, oh, I need to learn how to pace, then what do you notice about the dynamic? Does it pull in the spacer more? Like, what do you see? Like, oh, maybe couples coaching could be good. Or like, what do you notice when the chaser does start to do the internal pacing, if you will?
So the space that the spacer is creating, the faster somebody chases the faster the spacer is going to go. It's kind of like, you know, on a highway, you need more lead time than you do on a road. So they're going to increase the time because the speed is up. They're going to increase the distance there. Mm-hmm. But if you slow it down, they can also feel safer about coming back. So it's an easier place to shift to.
I'm going to, like, I have just a different identity now with spacer, chaser, and pacer. I will. Like, the pacer in your 5K, now I'm going to be thinking about Dr. Bokum.
Well, it also reminds me a little bit of, like, sometimes when we talk about the tool that Tara used, the code word, is that for the chaser, that the code word is almost a loss for the chaser. Because it's like, oh, no, I want to engage. I want to engage. And then that space of, like, no, like, calming yourself down, thinking about it coming back, they don't like that because it halts them trying to get closer.
Yeah, so it's scary because they're afraid they're going to lose this other person. So the balance in any relationship is two built-in fears that we both carry. Both people would carry the fear of intimacy, the fear of losing yourself to the relationship, and the fear of abandonment, of losing the person you want. And so those are intention. Right. And the chaser at that moment has their fear of abandonment activated. Mm-hmm. And so if they're hearing from me, you got to back off, part of their brain is going, I'll lose this person. Not recognizing that exactly what they're doing is accelerating the loss. Yeah. They're already doing that. And so that's one of the kind of re-understandings that I try to help people understand is that by pacing, they're actually increasing the potential for creating that connection they want.
So it's creating a safe energy for it. Yeah, go ahead.
So with that dynamic, does it put a lot of, like, more pressure on the chaser to be the person who becomes the pacer versus the spacer? You know what I'm saying? Like, so if the chaser needs to pace, what does the spacer need to do?
Well, so in some ways that's a moot question a lot of the time because the spacer's not listening, right? They're not a part of that.
Totally.
Yeah.
But if both people can go, you know what, we really do want to get somewhere, I just don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Then to recognize that their spacing is creating a distance that is counterproductive to getting to a long-term loving relationship, they can also go, okay, I do need to do pacing.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was doing a trail marathon for whatever reason, I don't know, was in my head, but I was doing a trail marathon out in the middle of nowhere. And my adrenaline was kicked in, and I was running my pace way beyond what I should have. And so I'm like, this is great. Then your first little bit, and I went down, I went, I'm going to cook myself here.
Yeah.
And that's why that pacer is so important, that both people have to find something that is a manageable pace together. And at this point, it may not be the closeness that either want, but they can begin to build. Can the person who has been chasing tolerate space better? Yeah. And can the spacer tolerate closeness a little bit better if they're working together? If they're working alone, then the chaser needs to draw back to the pacer. And one of the big mindsets is, can I be invitational with connection rather than feeling forced? I'm always telling people, if you hear yourself say, how do I make, get, cause, force my spouse to do anything? You need to back off because that's not at all invitational.
Oh, I like those words that you used. That actually is a good point because, like, when we introduce code word to the couples that come see us for therapy, like, I guess the chaser would be like, oh my gosh, they're going to use their code word and never come back. And, like, actually, there's an agreement, right? Agreement like, hey, we're going to take 30 minutes or an hour, and that both agree that they're going to come back and talk about it. But yeah, that fear of abandonment, like, initially when they're like, oh my gosh, you can use code word and then leave and never come back. And it's like, no, actually, hang on. We're going to agree that it looks like this so you're not out of your window of tolerance and creating more toxic anger, whatever. But you're going to agree that you come back and you're going to talk about it in a way that feels more invitational, like you said.
Well, and it also creates a way to agree on what is actually a good pace, right? You know, because one person would probably rather it be 10 minutes and the other person would be
3 days.
And it's like, okay, can we agree together of what's a reasonable middle point here about coming back together?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is missing in the understanding of the chaser about the spacer is that same anxiety that they're feeling, that their body is in a hypervigilant state. That's true with their spouse, too.
Yep.
You know, they think that their spacer is like, oh, I'm cool. I'm just going to stay distant. Yep. They're doing it out of their own panic.
Yes. Yeah. The same way I was like, oh, EJ, this is so bad, but I once called him a Buddhist mother effer. So how dare you be so calm? And really, like when we started to process it, he was like flooded in his own way and he was more frozen. Yeah. You know, but in that moment, I would never have thought that. I just thought he was just this cool, calm, collective.
Or punishing. I think you
or
all,
punishing,
I think people
right?
think that the stone that the pacer wall. Is punishing them by not being close. And really it's just like it's uncomfortable. The conflict is too much. Mm. There's like, how am I even supposed to show up?
I don't want to make it worse. All the
I don't want to make it worse. That's a big one too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That piece you put in there about they think they're punishing them or they think that so rarely is that actually true in a relationship that has the potential for health. I mean, there are toxic people out there that truly are punishing, but that's not general. That's not the kind of common, ordinary, everyday unhappy marriage that's disconnected. Yeah. That's a whole different level. Yeah. And so to be able to also assume the better of your spouse is important in the midst of that teamwork.
Yeah. Here's something that's always been challenging for me when I'm working with an individual who's there because of relationship issues, right? And knowing exactly what you are talking about because you're dependent upon their report, right? You're dependent upon what they're saying is happening at home. And so it's like, how do you help that person know whether they are dealing with a toxic person? Because you said, there are toxic people out there, you know, and there are, you know, abusive people out there. Like when it's in that subtle sort of emotional and communication realm, like how do you help them discern whether they just have a pacer versus they have somebody who know they're a stonewaller and they're doing this to manipulate you?
So I want to tease out just for a minute before we get there. You said the stonewaller, and a lot of people are going to relate that to John Gottman.
Yeah.
Sure.
One of the things that I've come to appreciate about Gottman's thing about stonewallers is that stonewalling is because you're flooded. Mm-hmm. And what has been twisted in kind of the popularization of that is the stonewaller has to change. And Gottman's whole research is that if somebody is flooding, you have to be aware of what's going on from your side that's flooding that other person.
Flooding.
You have to, there's a dance together. So the stonewalling is not in the true sense of that word, is not an aggressive thing. It is a defensive, I don't know what to do here.
Yeah.
And so that changes a little bit about, but I think the more telling is you use the term manipulative.
Yeah.
I think that's a better one. Somebody to have clear evidence of the manipulation is more evidence of the potential for toxicity. I think, unfortunately, a lot of times in troubled relationships, there is a lack of clarity for people. And so if somebody feels like their spouse is toxic, it is often a good thing to talk to a therapist, to check that out, to see if somebody from the outside is going, well, that sounds like, you know, this defense mechanism versus that sounds like there's a toxicity there. We're just not real good in the middle of a marriage crisis of assigning a fair level of responsibility /blame on the spouse.
Another kind of cousin of that is when I hear people say gaslighting.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And helping them understand like, okay, like what's gaslighting versus what's just a very different perception of an event.
Right.
And that doesn't mean your partner's like trying to manipulate you or is trying to make you crazy. They might literally, I mean, because we've had moments where once we get through it, we realize like, wow, we just had so uniquely different perceptions of what happened in that exact same moment. And I truly feel and felt and perceived it in that way. And it's perpendicular to the way you experienced it. And that doesn't mean that I'm being manipulative.
Well, and just to take it one step further, there is dishonesty. I think, I mean, I, research shows that we're all dishonest every day in some way. And so we've got that as a baseline. But gaslighting has, if somebody will say, well, you know, so their spouse said something that wasn't true. And they said, well, they're gaslighting me. I'm like, no, they lied to you. I mean, that's not okay. But that's not the same as somebody cooking up evidence to make you feel something. Crazy. So
that's so true.
I'll say this because this couple is so far back, nobody would know who they were. But I had this guy who pretended to go to work every single day. And this isn't the only one that's happened. So there can be multiple accounts of this. He'd go to a parking lot and read a paper and just goof off all day and come home and talk about his work day. No work life. Ran through their savings, ran through their retirement. Finally, when the house was being foreclosed on and he kept saying, oh, no, I put payments on it. His wife finally went, wait, maybe this is wrong. He then had himself created a letter on letterhead and had himself sent a job proposal. And he did that 3 times to keep her from taking action. That's gaslighting. He was building evidence to mess with her reality, as opposed to him saying, oh, you know, I quit instead of I got fired. That would be a lie and still not helpful, but a whole different thing than what he set up.
Building, I see a lot of that on Dateline, on Murder Mysteries. I'm sorry, I'm just saying a lot of gaslighting on Dateline. It is.
True.
Don't laugh. That's why I watch it, EJ. That's hilarious. Where do we want to go?
I mean, I just think those are a couple of things, actually, even though that's a little bit off topic, that I think are incredibly useful for people to hear, because there is this sort of like real dysfunction in the pop culturalizations of certain terms. And I think you're absolutely right about stonewalling, and that was a great clarification on gaslighting as well. I think that's useful to people.
And it's so funny because I can't tell you how many times we do consultations first to make sure a couple's like appropriate, that it'll be, you know, right? There's not like active DV or anything. And I'll have like a little like sticky note slipped into my pocket, like my partner's a covert narcissist. Uh-huh. And I'm like, okay, I see this. Like, but I do think like when you're watching things now, like Love is Blind and all like the new dating, I could count like 100 times the word gaslighting and narcissist is used. And I just feel like I love that you're clarifying it in that way, because it just feels like that's just your go-to now. And it's like, and then it's like, okay, now I'm out of here. And our whole thing is like, listen, you guys are in a place of despair, suffering. I don't know if this is going to work, but at least have some clarity first. Don't make a decision out of a flight, fight, freeze, fawn, all the stuff response. Let's get some clarity. Let's see what's happening, right? And then let's make that choice.
Yeah. I think a great wrapping up sort of way to look at this is, because our original topic was like, what do you do if you're the one who wants change, your partner doesn't? We use that chaser and spacer metaphor to help people have sort of a construct to look at it. And then, so maybe the last question, because we hear this so often, is like, well, how do I know when I should just give up?
Oh, yes, that's
good. You know, when I should just let go.
That is the tough question. I get the question many times of somebody saying, I would, you know, do your program, work with you, whatever, do anything you say, if you could guarantee me that I could save my marriage. And my response is, I can guarantee you what's going to happen if you continue on the track you're on. That's what we can guarantee. And the only way to figure out if something will work is to take action. And there are two possibilities as it goes forward, and that is that things start moving in a positive direction, and that the other is that you get clarity, and at some point you say, I've done all I'm willing to do. I think an important stopping point along the way is the point when you can look in the mirror and say, I feel good about what I did.
Yes.
I love that.
Not every marriage is going to be saved, but what I think is incredibly tragic is people going, I regret I didn't try harder. Yes. You can walk away and go, I did what I could.
Yeah.
Much better than I regret that I didn't take action. So action leads us to the place of finally being able to say, okay, that's as far as I'm going to go.
I love that. And I just remember feeling that about EJ. Like, I wanted to leave. I was so overwhelmed, Dr. Bokum. Like, I wanted to, but I was like, no, like, I know. I'm a therapist. I got to figure this out. This is information. So was EJ. But I mean, I was compelled to do it, but I'm just so grateful, because so many people, like, leave because that suffering feels like so much. But if you can get through that and feel like, I'm so glad I did that, whether it works out or not, like it just builds resilience and it just builds like confidence that like no matter what, I can handle it. Because we also know, right? And I know you know this research, first marriage is what, 48%, 40 whatever. Second marriage, it raises the divorce rate. Third marriage, it's the highest divorce rate, right? It follows us. So no matter what relationship you're in, like it's all about like recognizing what is it that I'm doing that keeps following me. I could marry someone totally different and the same stuff is happening, right? And so, yeah. I love your work. I know that we usually ask this in the beginning, but like what made you specialize with couples? We have so many therapists, like why would you want to work with couples? I'm like, I love it. I've loved it since I was 20 years old. But what made your heart want to do couples work?
So I got to watch my parents and my grandparents have very loving, connected relationships. My parents are still happily married in their mid-80s. I had that experience growing up, but I watched my cousins come out of broken homes. In fact, there are some cousins, I don't know where they are. They disconnected from the family. You talked about the lower rate, you know, as people go on. My uncle, I think, made it to 6, and it's possible 7. We're not quite sure about one person. And so then he finally figured out something at the end of his life. He stayed married, but 6 or 7 divorces and lots of pain and lots of other things along the way. And watching that with my aunts, I watched the impact and how it extended really right there for 3 generations. It affected my grandparents. It affected my aunts and uncles. It affected my nephews.
Wow.
I mean, my cousins. And then I had one of my cousins' kids contact me wanting information about the family because there's been so much cut off. That's a 4th generation effect from that original divorce.
Yes.
And so that made me quite clear about the importance of marriage. Watching my parents made me see the power of a strong marriage. And so when I decided to be a therapist, it just kind of, I kind of routed to marriage and family work just because of that.
I love that because I came from a very broken, traumatic childhood. And I was like, I know it doesn't have to be this way. So you came from like the secure, I know it could be this way. And I was like, I know it doesn't have to be this way. So I love that. I just always am so inspired by other humans that want to help couples suffer less because it truly does impact our children, our families, and we're change agents now in the generational pass down, right? It's huge.
Right. Yeah.
What are you thinking, EJ? I can tell you're deep.
I mean, I'm just thinking about a couple things. One thing that's always been cool is I feel like primary relationships are just like the building blocks of our community. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and when those are healthy, then all the other relationships splinter out of it. And that's kind of what you were saying, what you witnessed within your family was, you know, that this portion of your family who didn't have those good foundations, just that it's like the whole, you know, building your house on sand. You know, there's just nothing to root into. I was thinking about that, and I was just also thinking about working with an individual is great. But when you work with a couple, it's like it's happening right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that is like just so compelling and also like you can really make an impact. You can make it right there. And that's just like super, you know, super cool. So yeah, it's always great to meet another kindred soul in this path.
So if people are like, oh my gosh, I love Dr. Bocom. I really want to like do his program. I want to read some of his books. Like how do our listeners, we'll obviously have everything in our show notes, but how do they get in touch with you?
So one of the cool things we just started is an app for people who want to unpause their marriage. In fact, it's unpauseyourmarriage.com that goes to the app. And that is, we've created it in ways that deliver content to them and keep them moving forward, which is what I really wanted. How do you change those habits? So that's one of the pieces that has been helpful for people. And we've gotten great reviews on it. A good starting point just to kind of touch several of the things I have, because I also have an assessment for people who are like, is there a possibility in my marriage? You know, how do I know whether my marriage has capacity or not? I call it the GPS assessment. And you can find that plus a link to my system at savethemarriage.com/podcast. You're listening to us on a podcast. So savethemarriage.com/podcast will get you actually to all those possibilities and put you right on my webpage.
Great. All of those will be in our show notes. Yeah. So please, if you're listening to this and you're really connecting, please go ahead and check those out.
Well, and thank you so much for being on our podcast today. Your wisdom, you're amazing. I can feel your passion for couples, which I love. And as always, listeners, take care of yourself, take care of each other. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Me and you just singing on the train. Me and you listening to the rain. Me and you, we are the same. Me and you have all the fame we need. Indeed, you and me are we.
Most men aren't bad partners. They're just unequipped. You care about your relationship, but you keep having the same arguments. You shut down or you react, and then you regret it. That's not a character issue. That's a skill issue. And nobody ever taught you how to do this well. That's why I created Men Who Do the Work, an 8-week intensive to get better in your relationship. Not just talk about it, but actually practice it. You'll learn how to communicate without getting defensive and to stay grounded when things get tough and help stop the patterns that are breaking things down. Small group, 8 men, weekly sessions, real accountability. And you'll work directly with me. So if you know it's time to do things differently, reach out. coaching@relationshiprenovation.com. Let's get to work. Most men aren't bad partners. They're just unequipped. You care about your relationship, but you keep having the same arguments. You shut down or you react, and then you regret it. That's not a character issue. That's a skill issue. And nobody ever taught you how to do this well. That's why I created Men Who Do the Work, an 8-week intensive to get better in your relationship. Not just talk about it, but actually practice it. You'll learn how to communicate without getting defensive and to stay grounded when things get tough and help stop the patterns that are breaking things down. Small group, 8 men, weekly sessions, real accountability. And you'll work directly with me. So if you know it's time to do things differently, reach out. coaching@relationshiprenovation.com. Let's get to work.